All Ships America, and you are listening to A Bark, A Brig, and A Schooner Walk Into a Bar, a podcast where I get to know the people in our Tall Ships community. If you've been enjoying these episodes, please be sure to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Also, consider becoming a member or donating to Tall Ships America so I can keep talking to passionate sailors. Help us support the Tall Ships at tallshipsamerica.org. This week's guest is Mark Scabinico, port captain and director of maritime operations with the Galveston Historical Foundation, and one of the many caretakers of the tall ship Alyssa. We lean deep into learning about load lines, the challenges of a year-long restoration project, and the sheer freaking awesomeness of working with NASA astronauts. Also, I do want to apologize in advance for the phone ringing about 20 minutes into the episode. Normally, I try to edit that out, but Mark was on a roll, and my editing skills aren't that good quite yet. Welcome to my podcast. I'm super excited to have you here. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. If you could say your name, position, and organization, that would be great.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me. My name is Mark Scabinico. I'm the port captain and director of the Galveston Historic Seaport. The organization is Galveston Historical Foundation, and you might have guessed it, we're in Galveston, Texas.
So can you tell me a little bit about what the Galveston Historical Foundation does, what your role there is exactly?
Sure. So Galveston Historical Foundation, like lots of historical foundations around the country, is focused on the preservation of different parts of the history of Galveston itself. We're really unique in that we have our own maritime division, which is why we're connected here with Tall Ships America. So Galveston Historical Foundation manages properties. They do house restoration, rehabilitation. They're involved in some things like coastal resilience projects for hurricane prone areas that we're also involved in. We deal with the African American Heritage Committee. We deal in the maritime side of things, giving historic harbor tours. We take care of the 142-year-old National Historic Landmark, Tall Ship Alyssa, which is my primary focus. Just a whole host of different preservation interests. We even run a salvage warehouse on Broadway here in town that is where we take reclaimed timbers and windows and doors and doorknobs from houses that are being demolished or destroyed. And then we resell them back to the community for people doing their own restoration projects.
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't realize you guys did that. That's awesome.
It's super neat. Galveston's architectural heritage, since it's such an old city, really kind of forms the core of it. And then we get this cool chance to plug both the land and the seaside together, since lots of the houses that were built here were built from longleaf yellow pine out of Maine that were all brought here by ship in the late 1800s.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's awesome. Man, there must be some really cool stuff in there too. How do you not like want everything?
I go into salvage warehouse like once a week. Like, I don't own a house yet, but I'm totally going to buy lots of stuff from them.
So what exactly do you do with the tall ship Alyssa? You said she's 142 years old. She doesn't look a day over 50.
Oh, thank you.
But
I'll let her know you said that.
So what is your role there? What is your role there exactly then? What do you do with the ship?
The ship itself is 98% of the time a land-based attraction, right? So we're tied to the dock. And we do interpretive history with the vessel. We do that a number of different ways. There's a standard ticketed price where you come on board and you walk around and you get to look at and experience the vessel. We use a series of interpretive panels all around the ship that tell you the story of Alyssa, a little bit about the port of Galveston. And then we're tying that in with a brand new exhibit that we're going to be putting out, hopefully middle of next year at this point, called Ship to Shore, which pulls together all the aspects of port life here in Galveston from about 1880 to 1900. And so in addition to that, we also are a fully certified sailing school vessel. We run a crew training program, which I'm primarily responsible for, along with another staff member, our bosun. And like a lot of programs around the country, it's all volunteer run. We see somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 80 permanent volunteers every year, putting in somewhere around 30,000 hours a year.
Wow.
They do a sail training program that covers 20 Saturdays over 7 months. And that covers everything from basic line handling to ship terminology to navigational lookouts. And then that crew gets certified to be the sailing crew of the vessel along with a hired in cadre of officers for about 2 weeks every year. Unless we get lucky and pull off another Gulf Coast challenge here and get her underway for a little bit longer. So that's been Alyssa's mission pretty much the whole time. She's been here in Galveston since the late 70s, early 80s, is interpretive dockside programming and then sail training coupled with actual sailing of the vessel for a couple weeks every year.
And you even have your own beer? I would be remiss if I didn't mention. Do you want to talk about the Alyssa beer?
Yeah, I would love to. And we should totally get Brock to listen to this so we can give him a big shout out. Brock is the owner of St. Arnold's Brewing Company. They're based in Houston, Texas, which obviously is the closest large city north of us, about an hour away. Before my time with the company, they partnered up with Galveston Historical Foundation. Obviously, IPAs have a controversial but tied-in history with ships and shipping. They're closely associated with ships for the style of beer. Mm-hmm. And since they knew Alyssa was here in Houston, they cut a deal with us in order to use the ship's image in their logo and then obviously call it the Alyssa IPA. And as the trade-off for that, we get about 1.5-2% of their annual sales. And which is cool. It works out to somewhere around $10,000 to $20,000 a year, depending upon how drunk people are getting.
Drink responsibly.
Drink responsibly. We are working on
and drink Alyssa.
Yeah, and drink Alyssa. It's not widely distributed. St. Arnold's doesn't have a large distribution network yet. They're kind of in that in-between stage between micro craft brewery and getting big. So I'm hoping to see them get bigger and bigger. It's a good IPA too. I mean,
it
not
is.
That I wouldn't sell it, but it's good.
Yeah, it is good. I've had it, and I'm picky with my beer as I get older and older, but I have had it. It is delicious. So let's start at the very beginning with Tiny Mark. I know we've known each other for a really long time, although you remember meeting me, but as with most situations, I don't remember meeting anyone because usually I'm like completely oblivious to the world around me when I'm at work. But I know that you're from Maryland.
I am.
Did you grow up sailing or small boat racing?
So I did grow up sailing, kind of. We had a good friend of my father's who owned a 35-foot vessel in the Chesapeake Bay. I don't remember what kind it is. Doug will probably be mad at me forever. But he used to take us out in the summer for, you know, 3 or 4 days at a time. We would anchor different places in the northern Chesapeake Bay. And that was the first sailboats I ever got on. And I loved it. I thought it was awesome. And I did a little bit of sailing in Boy Scout camp. There's a camp on the Chesapeake called Camp Takawa. And I went there a couple of summers and did some small boat sailing there and also loved it. So I had exposure, but it certainly wasn't the number one thing on the agenda.
So usually my way to prepare for these interviews is poking around people's social media. So, but I saw that you went to the Culinary Institute of America. So here you are, you start out like liking sailing, enjoying it, and then obviously finding yourself at the Culinary Institute of America. Can you talk about how you went from being a potential chef? Were you ever a chef?
So I tried my darndest to drop out of high school. Like it was almost a mission of mine. And I was miraculously saved by my mother, who was determined that I was going to graduate high school. Right. And so she said to me when I was 18, and my mother's a wonderful, wonderful woman. I'm sure she's going to listen to this. She said, you can either be in school, meaning college. Mm-hmm. You can be actively applying for school, mm-hmm. or you can be paying rent. Those are your choices.
Okay.
Right? And I said, all right, that's pretty fair.
Yeah,
right?
She sounds very wise.
I'll pay rent. Just why would I pay it there, right? You know. So I found myself with no skills, really not really sure what I wanted to do with life. And the best thing I could get was washing dishes. And so I washed dishes for probably 2 years, working two jobs, like 14-hour days, and worked my way up in a kitchen in Newark, Delaware, to become the kitchen manager of this place called Homegrown Cafe. I think they're still there. They were very good. You can go check them out if you're in Newark, Delaware, University of Delaware, right? And the guy there had gone to the Culinary Institute of America, the owner of this restaurant. Mm-hmm. And he said, you ought to do it. I'll write you a recommendation letter. All right. So I did.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, here we go. I found my career, my purpose in life. I found focus, you know, lots of stuff in kitchens is about situational awareness, paying attention, fast-paced environment, you know. It's actually a lot of stuff that really makes sense down the road when you get
absolutely.
The sailboat.
Okay? Yeah, absolutely.
So I go to culinary school. It's a 2-year program, very intensive. At the time, they were very militaristic. They've eased up a little bit. The school was founded for World War II vets getting job skills when they came back from the war. So it was a mix of World War II veterans and World War II veterans from the other side of the war as well, because a lot of Germans and Austrians. So it was like this weird little mini cosm.
Wow. Well, Hyde Park, New York, a bastion of...
Okay. I almost saw World War III break out at that school.
I am not surprised.
So I stay there for a year extra as what's called a fellow, a teaching assistant. So I was working for the college. I was doing meat butchery and fish butchery, which is a specialty of the school. It's 2 classes, 6 months in each. And the guy who was the fishmonger chef is a famous guy named Corky Clark. He's in a bunch of books about the CIA. He has a giant United States Navy anchor tattoo, right? Mm-hmm. When I was in his class, he has these whole lectures that he goes on. And one of them is how he's been to all 7 continents, but he's never been on an airplane. So when I worked for this guy, when I was done, I had 2 job offers when I got out of school. One was for a 3-star Michelin restaurant in Scotland. And the other one was for a small passenger cruise ship that did adventure tourism. And starting out in the Falkland Islands, going to the Antarctic Peninsula, up to Ushuaia, Argentina. They did trips up and down the Amazon River. They did trips all along the South American coast. They crossed the Atlantic and went to Spain. They did all this kind of adventure tourism, 80 passenger vessels, right? So I said, chef, what should I do with my life, right? I'm like 20, 21, 22 years old. He glares at me and he goes, well, Mark, I don't know why, as a young man, you wouldn't want to go to sea. And I didn't know either. I was like, I don't know. I guess I'll go. So the next thing I knew, I was on an airplane flying to the Falkland Islands.
Shut the front door.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
22 years old. I spent a year working for that company, traveling all over South America and the Caribbean and going to the Antarctic. I've been to the Antarctic Peninsula probably 20 times.
Oh my God. That's awesome. Although what I really want to know is what are the Falkland Islands like?
They're the last sheep of the empire.
Yeah.
You got to protect those sheep.
Yeah.
They're cool, you know.
It's rock.
Yeah. There's lots of signs of unexploded ordnance. They fought a lot on that island.
Yeah, they did. There's a whole war.
Yeah, big one. Yeah. All right, so I told you this is a long story. I warned you.
I know, I'm loving it. I'm along for the ride, Mark. I'm fully invested.
So let me tell you, it's tough to work on a small passenger cruise ship. You're one of the only Americans. Working as the sous chef, it is 12, 14-hour days. I did 2 5-month hitches. So 5 months on the boat. Mm-hmm. You wake up at 5:30 in the morning, you go down into the galley, you put like a dozen or more trays of bacon in, you go smoke a cigarette. I mean, it's just nonstop, 14-day trips. Everything that goes into the cruise ship life, just in a small passenger deal, and then trying to like scramble eggs in the Drake Passage in like 20 meter seas. I have seen cruise ship windows smashed out by waveforms in the Drake Passage. I have seen some nasty, nasty weather down there.
Unbelievable. That doesn't surprise me at all. I'm surprised they were having you make like liquids, to be honest.
If you've ever poached eggs in a 20-foot sea, there's a 3-foot sea in the Switzer in the galley, right? Like,
yeah, you don't know the meaning of cooking eggs.
We could go on for hours, but that's not going to get us to the tall ship
that's
part,
gonna
right?
That's going to be in the second season. We're going to do a follow-up with you about cooking on board a small passenger vessel in the Drake Passage. Yes.
It's nutty. It's really nutty. All right. So,
yeah.
Right? I just can't take it anymore. Like, I was like, the boat part's cool. The travel is cool.
Sure.
The environment wasn't working for me. So I moved to New York City. I've got some friends there. I still work as a chef. Mm-hmm. I worked in a number of different restaurants in Brooklyn and in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And I realized that most of my life was spent in the dark.
Yeah.
either being yelled at or yelling at other people for how small the carrots were cut. That was my life.
Yeah. Yep.
I was like, this is stupid. If I'm going to be stressed out about something, I would rather it be that, like, someone's in immediate peril, not that, the chicken has been cooked a degree under or the carrot is not a perfect cube. Like, I'm just burnt. And it happens to a lot of cooks.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Dating a girl in New York City. She gets a scholarship to go to South Africa. I obviously don't have the money to follow her. I'm going to be winter in New York City by myself. Hating life. I was like, all right, I got to get out of here. Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. I found the Tall Ships America Billet Bank. And Grays Harbor Historical Foundation, Grays Harbor Historical Society was hiring cooks. I didn't know anything about the tall ship industry. I didn't know anything about any of this world that exists. It just said, you know, cook for a vessel. It was like 8 to 10 crew, sometimes a few larger, live on board. Good pay rate. I had tons of sea time. I had my Bohemian, you know, Siemens discharge record book. I had who knows how many thousands of miles underway at that point, cooking for 80 people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got the job right away.
Right.
You can start to speed it up. I go out there. I'm like, this is super awesome. I took the train, actually. I took the train all the way across the country from D.C. to Jack London Square. So I took the train, got on board a square rig sailing ship. And then this is the long story short part. Subsequently, I then sailed on traditional ships all the way up and down the West Coast, all the way through the Panama Canal, all the way up and down the East Coast, all the way through the Great Lakes, right? And so I basically like circumnavigated North America by rail and by ship, like it's like Lewis and Clark's trip.
So how long were you a cook on board? How long were you a cook on board, and how long did it take for you to realize, I don't want to be a cook anymore, I want to be up on deck?
I think it took probably 6 to 8 months. I'm not sure the exact timeline there. I worked for them for a total of about 2 years. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I just didn't want to cook anymore. And I had gone from cooking for 80 people for 3 meals a day to 8 people for 3 meals a day.
Yeah.
So, and when I showed up, the cook they had was a horror show, and they were starving, and it just wasn't working out. You know, it happens, right? But I had plenty of free time. As the cook on a tall ship, 3 squares, hot, healthy, and on time, right? Mm-hmm. And dietary restrictions. If you can handle that, you can sleep the rest of the day.
Right.
I just started going on deck, you know, like, hey, what's that thing do? You know, can I go aloft, you know? How do we do this?
Yeah.
And coupled with some sailing background, I mean, I just got caught up in it. And then I just, you know, position to position to position.
Right.
Found different ships, found different people to take me on. I worked for Lynx for a while. We brought Lynx to Florida. I did that Panama Canal trip.
You did that Panama Canal trip. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I met Jamie Trost as part of that Lynx deal. He was a release captain for a little bit there. I got on flight to Baltimore. You know, I did some odds and ends out on the West Coast a little bit. I didn't ever work for any of the other companies, but just, you know, filled in, took a day sail, did a tall ship festival. It's, we met in 2008 with the whole Kaisei deal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you were on Kaisei?
No, but a lot of my fellow sailors that I worked with for Grays Harbor were all involved that. Captain Jake Jacobson, who recently passed away, is an icon of this industry to us. He was part of that whole deal. And he was the captain for Lynx's transit through the Panama Canal. Yeah, so I sailed for him for quite a while. And through Jamie Trost, you know, I had always wanted, once I found out about this whole tellship world, being from Maryland, I wanted to go work for Pride of Baltimore.
Right.
I did that trip. We did a Great Lakes season, as they often do. And then I was kind of burnt on tall ships. You know, I had been on board and underway a lot for, it had been 6 or so years at that point or more. And I went commercial for about a year and a half, maybe it was 2 years. I worked for Dan Marine Towing. We did hawser tugs. We pushed home heating oil up the frozen Hudson and towed a barge between New York and Virginia. Then I couldn't take that. And I was like, well, I guess I'll go back to tall ships. and then I was working for the Lothies in Yorktown, Virginia for Schooner Alliance in 2011, 2012. They're just salt of the earth, great people, phenomenal sailors, great organization.
Yep.
And they were interested in keeping me on, but, you know, I was also looking at other opportunities, and the job for waterfront manager bosun position opened up here in 2012. I applied, got the job, and moved to Texas, sight unseen.
Yeah.
And I've been here ever since.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's been a long time. It's almost 8 years, right?
Yeah. We'll be hitting 8 years here at this point.
Wow. God, time flies, doesn't it? Jeez.
I know. It's crazy.
It is crazy. Do you still cook at all? Do you cook on board Alyssa at all? Or do you tend to stay away from the kitchen on board a ship?
I have made breakfast on Alyssa twice. And that's because the cook broke her foot. I do cook at home. Only recently. I got married 2 years ago.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. That started me cooking back at home a lot. Having somebody else to cook for makes a big difference.
So we
cook at home a lot now.
Yeah, anyway.
All right, we are going to talk about boats at some point, right? This whole thing's not just going to be about me being a cook, is it? Because that gets old.
The thing I did really want to talk about was your NASA program aboard Alyssa. Can you explain when that was, what you guys did, what exactly it entailed?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're really proud of it. There's some parts of it that are actually a little proprietary. So there's some things I can talk about and some things I can't because it's in conjunction as a training program with NASA. So we just kind of have to, we'll be talking about what we did in kind of a factual way, right? Because NASA, if they're going to endorse anything in a public way, they do that on their own, right?
Okay.
And they have a whole big PR office that handles all of that, gets it all done. So this was an idea that cropped up by happenstance, as things do in tall ships. One of our good, solid volunteers, the Deckers, they have a marital connection to a former ambassador of the United States, Gene Christie, who's also a volunteer of ours, super great guy.
Cool.
And they are connected to a couple of folks who were astronauts. We took a piece of Alyssa's deck planking, and it went up in the International Space Station and got floated in the International Space Station. And then it came back down, and we got a little plaque and a certificate of authenticity. So Gene Christie happened to know Katie Coleman, who is an astronaut. She's, let's see, two space shuttle missions, left the International Space Station in 2011 as a crew member. So I think she's the one who actually took the piece of decking, and I can confirm that. So she came down for a sail or two, you know, to do the whole deal. She wore the NASA suit to say, you know, I'm here to, you know, in support of sailing, and, you know, it's a kind of a PR piece. And we took some pictures with her, with the crew. You know, Houston being here so close, it's kind of a natural fit. And through two serendipitous events, this one being Katie being on board the vessel, and another total random one in about 2013 or 2014, I was just trying to meet people in Galveston. And so I'd made a couple of friends at the local pub, and we had gone over to another friend's house. And I got to talking to this gal, Christina Cook. It turns out she's an astronaut in training. She's in the trainee program to become an astronaut.
That's so cool.
Yeah, right. And I was like, wow, that's like so cool. Like, you're awesome. And she asked me what I did. And I said, well, you know, I work for the tall ship Alyssa, and we do sail training programs, you know, historic sail training programs. She was like, that is so cool. She was like, do you know Katie Coleman? And I was like, why, yes, I do. I had taken her up in the rig. We had had all that kind of stuff. And I said, Christina, we got to do something. Like, this has been a dream of mine forever. I have joked for years and years that tall ships are the spaceships of their era, because to me, they really are.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is more anomalous than space flight to traditional sailing in the golden ages of sail, when there's no radio communication, you're totally self-sufficient, all of your navigation. I mean, it just clicks all of the boxes.
Yeah.
We've had some other NASA connections. Harry Byington, who was one of the rocket scientists for the Apollo missions, was a volunteer for us for a long time.
That's awesome.
He passed away a couple of years ago. He was still climbing in the rig when he was 86, and I led him because he was strong as an ox. He would tell awesome stories about Buzz Aldrin and stuff. So, you know, we've had a lot of other connections. Oh, yeah, yeah. So it gets better.
That's so cool.
So Christina and I concocted this idea, and we think this is a really cool program. I wanted to pitch it. She was willing to, you know, pin her merit on it and say, you know, I think this is a good idea. I think it has value. And then the proprietary stuff would be all of the course development that we had to do as part of that. And so that had to be vetted by Johnson Space Center. Obviously, their funding comes from Congress.
Right.
And so basically, we fit into a slot where they used to do an outdoor ropes course or something along that line. And we took this training and we said, look, it, not only does it meet what you're doing for this other training program, but it far exceeds it in terms of the leadership, teamwork, the followership, close aboard living conditions. Like, you know, you can rattle off the different points that make a lot of sense in terms of living in a space shuttle or working on a long-term mission in a hostile environment, obviously, like space.
Right.
And it was pitched and it was accepted. We had to do a sole source, obviously. usually you have to get three competitive bids, but we put a sole source exception in for it.
Right.
And so we've only run one. We were trying to get another one off the ground, but then, you know, the world had a global pandemic.
Right.
a few other things in the pipeline. And, you know, the astronauts training is rigorous and they dump millions of dollars into each of those individuals to ensure that they are 100% ready to do this. So, you know, it had to have value, which SAIL training does.
Yeah, absolutely.
To the nines, right? You can prove it 100%. Yeah, so the pilot program we ran was three incredible women, Mary Lawrence, Megan MacArthur, and Christina Cook. Mary Lawrence is actually a flight director, so she actually runs mission control and handles all the comms and communications as the team leader for the, you know, shore side of thing. I mean, quite literally, when you say, Houston, we have a problem, she could be one of the people on the other end of that call.
Oh my God, I just have chills.
Yeah. And then Megan MacArthur, an astronaut, she was part of the Hubble Telescope mission. There's probably some other amazing accomplishments that I am missing of hers. Really, really cool. And then Christina Cook, who was really the staple of this. We worked hand in hand a lot to develop the criteria and figure out what was NASA looking for, what could we pitch, you know, what would it look like. And she just recently returned to Earth a few months back, and she now holds the record as the woman to be the longest in space. I think it's like 380 days. And she participated in the first ever all-female spacewalk up there. So they're just incredible people.
That's so cool.
And they really helped us probably more than we helped them. I mean, I would like to think that we helped them. I don't know how much a Boland worked out in space. I intend to find out.
Yeah, yeah.
I missed my chance to send Sainfine to the International Space Station. I cannot, I'm still kicking myself, but I think there's going to be another opportunity. But, you know, it's all about that close aboard living skills, you know, the ability to work as a team in a confined environment. And one thing I forgot that I thought really neat parallel, we did a week-long training at the dock, like an intensive, and then they got underway with us for 5 days of day sail. That's how the final program actually worked. And we were discussing the three kind of main shipboard drills that you always practice, which is fire, man overboard, and abandoned ship. I mean, obviously you have damage control and, you know, there's other categories that fit there, but that's kind of the classic three that you deal with is fire, man overboard, and abandoned ship. And I think it was Christina who said, yeah, we have basically three drills that we do in the International Space Station, and they're fire, abandoned ship, and toxic environment. Because, you know, if you get a fire in the space station, it's literally sucking the oxygen out of the area that you need to breathe and you can't keep up on it. So then it's a toxic environment and then it's immediately, you know, Soyuz abandoned ship. So it's just like some of the parallels, you know, as maritime led to aviation and then aviation led to space flight. It was it was neat to see that history chain. It was cool to be on board a vessel from 1877 and like reach all the way out to 2020 and touch the International Space Station.
Yes.
Like, that is killer.
That is killer. Oh, that's so, that is just freaking awesome, man.
I just made that up. It sounded really good. Cut it.
It did
cut
sound it. Really good. Man, that must have been just to be around people like that is, God, I'm so jealous.
It was really fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we really had to put our best foot forward in order to showcase the program. You know, it's not something you can cook up overnight.
Right.
And we got some really, really awesome feedback out of the program. The way that NASA takes the data that it gets and then provides feedback on all levels of their organization. They uh-huh. brought some of that to us, and we've found that very useful in our programs going forward. A lot of that bridge resource management stuff that you look at, that really makes a difference in the modern world. You know, it's not the 70s anymore. You know, it's not time for a single person to hold all the power. I mean, ships are not democracies. We all know that. They have to work in a command and in a control environment.
Sure,
but
sure.
The way that has been developed for the flow of information, so you get mm-hmm. the best possible outcome and you make the right decisions and make the right choices, it's been really fun to learn a lot of that systems that NASA uses and see how we can apply it to a tall ship training program.
Oh, that's awesome. I can't wait to see what comes of that. I just think that's so cool.
I'm really hoping in some future years we can continue the training and move it on a little further. Alyssa, at the time when we did the SAIL training program, was still in the stages of getting recertified as a sailing school vessel. We were right in this transition period. So a little background. When I got here in 2012, Jamie White was the director at the time. They had discovered extensive damage, some of that most likely out of some electrolytic issues in Hurricane Ike and other causes that were unknown to me. And they had dry docked, I think, in 2010, and they had found an extensive series of pinholes in the underwater hull.
What does that mean for those?
So actual little holes in the metal.
Ooh, okay.
And they weren't actually weeping. Some of them weren't full penetration, but there was thinness in some of the iron plating and in some of the steel plates that were renewed in the 70s and then subsequent years, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it was extensive, and it was surprising because in their previous dry dock, which had only been 2 or so years before, they had seen none of that. So it was a very short window for what seemed like a lot of deterioration. And I wasn't here for those dry dockings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I defer you to some people that were part of that.
Sure.
I have some photos for it. But in any event, they estimated the repair needs right around $3 million because the deck also was in need of replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And FEMA stepped in with quite a bit of funds for that after Hurricane Ike, as well as, you know, some other pieces for it. And then Dwayne Jones, who's the executive director of Galveston Historical Foundation, along with Joe Wilhelm, who was a board member at the time, several other board members, the Galveston Historical Foundation, you know, marketing and development team, they raised the rest.
Wow.
And they wound up with right around, I don't know the exact number, but somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.2 to $3 million for this major restoration. And
mm-hmm.
probably is part of the reason I got hired, because they had some funding to pull another person on board as a full-time staff member. So I got here. We immediately took the ship to dry dock within like 4 or 5 months of me having been there.
Mm-hmm.
We were almost a year in dock. Wow. We replaced a ton of plate. And we came back and we entirely ripped the rig out by its roots. We pulled every eyebolt, you know.
Whoa.
I mean, every piece of deck furniture. I craned off, you know, the galley house, craned on a new galley house. We took all the anchoring gear, capstans and windlasses all apart, took them up to a place in Lufkin, Texas Metal Casters, did a lot of restoration work for us. So it was almost a full second restoration, as we call it, in that 2014-2015 time period.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a ton of work.
I know.
and then subsequently, right at that time, of course, as those in the tall ship community know, but some of our lay folk might not, is also when the Coast Guard came out with new standards for rigging inspection of vessels. Been a long time coming after some incidents in 2008. You know, some of our esteemed colleagues in the traveling inspection office, like Mark Kruder, have been big, you know, proponents mm-hmm. of getting this done. And then I know there was a lot of great work done through your guys' committees at Tall Ships America to help guide some of that process. And there, a lot of them are listed as contributing editors on there, which is awesome. Thank you, mm-hmm. Tall Ships. You guys mm-hmm. did a great job. But so then we had to really dig into the rig, and we've spent the last, you know, 4 or 5 years replacing forestays and rebuilding trestle trees. And we've built one whole new gas boom, about a 55-foot spar we built in-house, you know, all the kind of stuff you have to do on any regular ship. But it's just been every year, we've just been renewing and replacing and restoring and reinterpreting a lot of what goes on with Alyssa herself. So she was regulated in an unusual manner in the late 70s, early 80s in the United States. The mm-hmm. whole concept of a sail training vessel was a new idea mm-hmm. in a lot of ways.
Right.
And for her first few years, she didn't have an engine. So by U.S. law, she wasn't a motorboat. So it didn't right. really matter. It didn't matter right. how big she was. She's 367 tons, 205 feet. She's not a small girl.
No, she's not. For the
U.S. market, it's pretty big, you know.
Yeah, she is. Yeah.
And so they had been operating as subchapter I, which is general commercial cargo, because that was the box that they thought they fit in. Because sure. when they did the 1986 voyage, they actually didn't bother to tell the Coast Guard that they had put an engine in it.
Oh, hey.
Whoops-a-doodle. That didn't go over so well, as you can imagine. I found some memos in the desk that were pretty to the point. They've been doing
it. She went from Galveston up to New York in that. Transit, 86. Right, for 86. Yeah.
Right. When they came home, the Coast Guard was like, so guess what? You're now subject, you know, this is not what we were talking about. This is changed. So she became subchapter I, cargo, mm-hmm. Which is usually, you know, commercial. Not very, you'll probably won't find another tall ship that has one. Although as soon as I said that, someone's going to go, I have one.
don't at me. That's fine.
So, and then she would get excursion permits, which is uh-huh. A thing that the Coast Guard can do under certain times with the permission of the local officer in charge, Marine Inspection, OCMI. But it's really not, it's kind of skirting it a little bit. Mm. And it could be called into question a little bit as to, if you're doing this every year, why is it an excursion permit? Why aren't you bound by some regulatory box that makes more sense for who you
right,
are.
Right,
so
right.
So SSV had come out in the, I think in the 90s, it allowed exclusions for foreign built hull, which can mm-hmm. sometimes be a big deal. Mm-hmm. Melissa was built in Aberdeen, Scotland in 1877, so she's not a US built vessel, but sailing school vessel provides for that. And they said, you guys are going to need to stop this. This is right kind of when I took over in 2016, 2017, right in that neighborhood when Jamie left to go do the waiver tree project. And they said, so guess what? It's sub R or sub nothing. And we're going to have to figure this out. And so that started about 5 years of my life to find out how we could put a load line on a 142-year-old vessel that ABS initially was not too keen to do. We've done some presentations about this at the tall ships conferences. And it's worked out really well in the end, but it scared a lot of people at first.
I'm sure.
Because they're looking at a old vessel. They just saw $3 million worth of repair and restoration. It's a risk-averse world, and everybody immediately goes to, what are you doing? What's your training? What's your plan? What's your program? You know, or is this safe to do this? Can you mm-hmm. even meet the requirements? Mm-hmm.
So what exactly does a load line mean, and what did it mean for Alyssa?
Sure. So load lines for vessels of certain sizes are required in order for you to go outside the boundary line, which is 12 miles from shore in most places. There's some fluctuation, but you know, pretty much it's entering into what you would call international waters. So if you're going to do that by convention, especially a vessel of Alyssa's size, 367 gross tons, she has to have a load line. That's issued by one of several load line authorities around the world.
So what exactly is a load line, though? I get that it's part of the regulation, okay. But what exactly, I mean, can you only load the vessel up to a certain point?
You do work for Tall Ships America, right?
I do. However, I've never had to get a load line.
Load lines were started in the 1800s to determine how much cargo you could put on a vessel. And the idea was for safety. It was to stop the greedy ship owner from overloading the vessel in order to make maximum profit of putting the ship into an unstable condition, right? So that's where you get the birth of the load line. Okay. Lloyd's of London, I think, is the first to start issuing load lines. And it's mostly for insurance, for the purpose of insurance in order to insure your vessel. There's got to be some reason. And since it has evolved to life and safety at sea, SOLAS conventions, IMO conventions, and several what they call class societies, because there's class and load line only, got together the first international ratification of International Load Line Convention is in 1933. I think I have that right. 1930 or 1933.
Okay.
And that groups all of the major nation states around the world in an international agreement as to what we're going to allow, what's going to be safe, how much cargo can you take, what's the math on this, you know,
right. All
those kind of things. That's Detmorsch Veritas out of, you know, regions in Germany. There was Germanisch Lloyd, there's Lloyd's of London, there's right. The American Bureau of Shipping,
right.
Bureau Veritas out of France, there's a few others.
Right.
And so they all agree to a unified standard for certain parts of the convention. So mm-hmm. even though Alyssa is an American ship, I could have a Lloyd's load line.
Okay.
I could have a Detmorsch Veritas load line
right.
because they would all agree to uphold the convention. But okay. even though she's Scottish built, she's an American flag, American sail training vessel. The offices of the American Bureau of Shipping are an hour and a half north of us. Their centralized office is here.
Right.
And we wanted to have an ABS load line. So mm-hmm. that's what we went for.
Mm-hmm. No, it makes sense. And you guys were able to participate in our event.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
By
like this much, like the ink was still drying. We literally tapped the load line on the hull at the Tall Ships Galveston Festival.
I remember, I was there.
Sunday before we left. And the wind and tide were such a state because the load line mm-hmm. is ultra conservative. That was part of the, you know, deals that we made was to have a really conservative load line because obviously right. we're not going to carry a load of coal or cargo. So
right.
you know, to help make everybody feel safe and feel that we were doing the right thing, you know, we went with the most conservative load line. So it's almost at the water line, even
right.
though we're pretty high out of the water.
Like yeah.
it would have been really loaded. But so we actually wound up careening the ship with festival passengers in the slip. So we had put like 100-some or 120 people on board. And we just closed off the gangway and made them all go stand on the starboard side while like Michael Ferrantino and my now wife and John basically gave them like a 20-minute story about the load line.
Right.
All the while leaning over the side of the hull to a guy who's in a small boat going, "Are you done yet?" Then we had to do the other side.
It was very exciting. And had the people there were like, "What's going on?" Yeah, it was, I think I got a few photos of it too. It was very exciting. My question then too is, because you're talking about doing all of this, talking about all of the restoration and replacing onboard Alyssa, how much of her is there any original left on board Alyssa?
So there's original hull left on board Alyssa.
Just the hull, okay.
And yeah. there's about two or three pieces in the officer's quarters that are, we believe, original to the vessel.
Okay.
And then a lot of the paneling that was replaced in the 80s, we actually still have in a warehouse here on Galveston Island as part of accession pieces that all the new pieces were patterned after.
Mm-hmm.
So Alyssa, you know, the guys in the 80s who did the initial restoration did a phenomenal job on mm-hmm. the vessel in documentation, in their rigging expertise, you know, they really high quality work.
Right.
It's an incredible feat of restoration. I mean, somehow they managed to get an insane amount of money dumped on them. And even
right.
that's never enough. But I mean, really,
right.
I mean, top notch, first class restoration.
Yeah, she's stunning. She still is. I mean, you would,
yeah.
honestly, I know I was a little facetious at the beginning, but honestly, she looks like she was launched in the 80s. She really does. Right. She doesn't look like a 143-year-old
yeah.
vessel.
And you know, she's a National Historic Landmark. She was mm-hmm. registered as that. And so we follow the Secretary of the Interior standards for historic vessel preservation that was put out mm-hmm. in the 90s. We adhere to that as closely as we can, even to the detriment of some folks. You know, we've shifted away from bright, shiny plastic varnish
mm-hmm.
because it's a modern material. Plus, I hate dumping plastic into the ocean.
Right.
And we've gone back to a traditional finish, which is, you know, linseed oil with some tar and turpentine. That's like a boat soup or a tarred oiled finish. And
yeah.
we've actually had to answer a bunch of questions. People be like, "Why doesn't it look shiny anymore?" And we're like, "Well, it's a traditional oil finish and
right.
it's soaking into the timber." You also got to remember, I have a largely wooden vessel in the near tropics.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're really far south.
Yes, yes, you are really
super hot. The sun burns down here all the time. It's latitude 23. It's foggy for 4 months out of the year. We call it fog season. It's like being in a tropical jungle. So there's a lot of challenges for that much wood in that environment that you don't get when you get a cold season in some of the other parts of the world. And so the tar and oil has really done the job of cutting the cost of that maintenance portion and then allowing us to focus on the important stuff in the rig. And I still think an oil finish looks gorgeous. But Alyssa carried coal. You know, she carried wool and wood and cargo. And to finish actually answering your question, I'd say probably maybe 60% of the hull is original. Maybe a little less.
That's still pretty impressive, actually. Well,
a lot like Star of India, although Star of India is actually even more stoutly built, if you can believe it. So we refer to framing in ships as the ribs, like when you see a wooden boat being built, the skeleton structure of that. So those would be your frame. And the closer they are, the tighter your framing, the more rigidity a vessel has. And Alyssa's frames are 22 inches on center, which is really, really close. And the midships plating, so the thickness of the iron at the midships or middle of the vessel as built was 9/16. So when they built vessels like this in the 1870s, they were using iron, but they didn't understand just how strong it was. You could build a vessel of Alyssa's size with half the thickness, half the stoutness, easily, maybe less.
Most
modern ships aren't anywhere near those types of thicknesses or frame spacing. So she's built like a battle tank because they knew wood boat construction, and they were building riveted iron ships to wood boat standards. So yeah, we actually have the 1877 Lloyd's Guide for Vessels because she was certified as an A1 vessel. We have all of her Lloyd's records going all the way back to her building.
That's incredible. I would like to pose, you know, if you had unlimited funding, we weren't in the middle of a global pandemic, what would you like, what would you like to see Alyssa do? What would you like to, how would you like the program to evolve?
It's going to sound boring, but I'm going to say a lot of the same. I'll support it a little bit, I think. I think there's several factors at play here. She is a staple of maritime history, right? She's one of the oldest vessels in the world that still actively sails. So entropy is real. And when you take something sailing that is as old or older than the Statue of Liberty, right? I mean, you're putting use on it. When you put use on it, you sometimes contribute to some of its deterioration. And there's risk that goes along with that as well. And a big part of her purpose is to interpret the maritime history of Galveston and the maritime history of the United States, and to be a preservation piece for people to walk on board, to do programs on board, to take school trips on. We see thousands of school kids every year to showcase that history, and to be a working example of that type of sailing vessel. But at the same time, if she just sits at the dock and never goes sailing, then you lose all that magic, right? Because now, now you've got an opportunity to take something that is the real deal, the genuine artifact, and get her underway. And it is awesome.
It is awesome.
She sails so well. Even
she is
as,
just stunning.
Even as light on her lines as she is, she could have a much deeper draft. You know, fully loaded with cargo, she would make a lot less leeway, would make a fair bit. But even with that, she handles well, she tacks well, she sails well. All of those pieces. And then you can't underestimate the volunteer aspect of this preservation project. Because she doesn't go sailing all the time is how we get so many volunteers who can keep their Monday to Friday job and come down and dedicate their weekend to do all of the maintenance, to keep the ship looking as good as it is, so we can go take the boat sailing for a couple weeks out of the year. And it feeds this loop, you know, where it's like, you got to go sailing a little bit because you need to take volunteers out to preserve maritime skills. And then what we're just seeing is that we're just increasing the skill set of that program.
Right.
And when we do go sailing, we have really shifted the focus in the last couple of years since we've become a sailing school vessel to not just using Alyssa as a, you know, big donor platform, or come sailing with us because you gave us so much money. Not that we don't still do that. Please give us money. We would be happy to take your money. Mark@GalvestonHistory.org. Feel free to get in touch with me. We are emphasizing the sailing school portion of this, and we've been doing small group youth programs, about 8 to 10 youth between the ages of 12 and 17 that get underway and go sailing with us. We've started to do a little bit of partnership with a local maritime high school. There's one in Texas City that's doing maritime training. I'd like to see us get more involved in that program, which a lot of other vessels around the country are starting to do.
Right.
I work in a volunteer capacity. My volunteer job is to work with the advisory committee for San Jacinto Maritime College here in the Houston area. Mm-hmm. Provides training to brown water and blue water sailors for professional development. So we'd like to incorporate a little bit more of those things in our program and just keep upping that level of sailing professionalism and just seeing what we can do with this ship. It's like the best archaeology experiment ever. Like you read all those history books where the people that work in universities that have fancy degrees, they'll say, oh, square rig sailing ships can only sail downwind. And you're right. Like, you've never been on a square rig sailing ship, or you would know that that is absolutely not true. Like, do you think the Battle of Trafalgar was fought downwind? Like, it's not how this works. It's just not a modern race boat.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so I really love bringing that to people. And I love that she's a community staple, because we also provide this, you know, really awesome connection to all the people that participate with us. I jokingly call it the Church of Alyssa. We go to weddings, baby births, funerals, you know, we do it all. We put all that all and effort into it. It becomes like a community.
Babies getting born back aft.
You right got there, weddings going wedding on. Up forward. I got married on board.
Yeah.
I've had the sad task of putting a lot of friends' ashes over the side. You know, but that connection, that
the community connection, that sense of beautiful real sense of ownership. Like, people are, there's a strut to it.
I carved that. I rust busted that rivet.
there's a lot of ownership, and we definitely saw that during the challenge. You know, that people were so, and with any volunteer group, you do find it.
And we train so hard. You'll never see people, you know, some of whom never saw the maritime world before they started the Alyssa training program. And man, believe me, they know where every fire extinguisher is. They know all classes of fire. They know the first thing to do in an emergency drill. Right. You know, we pride ourselves when the Texas City Coast Guard comes down to do our drills, you know, in advance of our sailing season, that we show as much, if not better, than a professional crew would show, because there's so much. It's not just coming to work.
Right.
You're here to do the right thing, to do the job right, to learn the skills.
Right. And, you're there because you love it. Yeah. You love doing, you love the job, and you love the ship, and you love the community. And there's, you definitely tell. Yeah. You can definitely tell.
It's awesome.
It's cool. It is awesome. It's really neat. It really makes me want to have an Alyssa beer and sit on the deck and talk to people.
Yeah. We're hoping to do that coming up next year. We're hoping to actually be able to sell you an Alyssa beer at the historic seaport, so you can have an Alyssa on Alyssa.
Thank you so much, Mark, for taking the time to talk about Alyssa. It's really been illuminating. Our conversations are always a teachable moment, I find.
Well, yeah, thanks, Erin. It's really great to be here. We really appreciate everything that Tall Ships America does for the sailing community. You guys have definitely made an impact on my life over the years. So, you know, I'm happy to be a part of it, and I'm so glad that this is all working out well for you guys.
I know, and I really, really can't wait until we can actually have a Tall Ship Alyssa beer on board Tall Ship Alyssa in Galveston.
I look forward to that.
I do too.
A bark, a brig, and a schooner walk into a bar is a Tall Ships America production. The music provided by Kebab Studios. You can find us in all the usual places, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Tall Ships America, and on our website at tallshipsamerica.org. Send us your sea stories or drop us a line at manager@tallshipsamerica.org. As always, be sure to support your local tall ship.